If your pill changed color, would you still take it?
Is niacin beneficial in high-risk patients?
Can we employ telemedicine to help people manage pain?
And the stroke incidence and mortality in the United States, better or worse?
That's what we're talking about this week on PodMed, the weekly look at the medical headlines from Johns Hopkins, posted on July 18th, 2014. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang, president of Texas Tech University Health Science Center in El Paso and dean of the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine.
Rick, I would like to start with this one on pills changing color. That's in Annals of Internal Medicine, a study taking a look at when pills change color and presumably perhaps also shape. People say, oops, I'm not taking that anymore. What's up with that?
You know, this was an interesting study. And you look and you say, gosh, I wish I'd have thought about that. And so here's the premise. We know that generic drugs are really essential to pharmacologic care in the United States because they're inexpensive. And the FDA has actually identified certain generic drugs as being bioequivalent or the same as trade drugs. By using generic medications now, it's estimated that we've contributed to $1 trillion in savings in the U.S. healthcare system over the past decade. This study realized that when people have heart attacks, if you monitor their medication use over the next year, medications we know that improve their outcome, that about half of the patients don't adhere to those prescribed medications. Do generic medications contribute to that in one way or another? Specifically, if a person has a change in their medication that results in a change in the color of the pill or the shape of the pill, does that somehow affect the individuals taking that medication or their compliance? So they looked over the course of about 5 years, patients who were discharged from the hospital after having a heart attack and were recommended to receive medications like a beta blocker or a cholesterol-lowering medication or ones called ACE inhibitors. And they identified, after looking at over 11,000 individuals, those that did not continue to take their medications as prescribed. And that was about 29% of patients. And they compared them to those that continued their medications. And what they discovered was for the patients that had a change in the color of their pill, they were 34% more likely not to be taking their medication. And if it changed in shape, it decreased use by about 66%.
I find that absolutely bizarre. If you changed the color or the shape of a pill, as far as I'm concerned, but I felt convinced that it was something I really needed to take, I feel certain I would continue to take it. Was there any exploration of why people did this?
There's no explanation because this was just an analysis of a database. But I can understand this from a physician standpoint because oftentimes a patient would come back for their 3 or 6 month visit and say, Doc, I went to the pharmacy and they gave me the wrong pill. And so I didn't take it. And in fact, the pharmacy formulary had changed to a different generic. So here the patient thinks they're doing the right thing for their health by not taking the wrong medication, but in fact, they're doing deleterious things to their health. So what this informs me is that as a physician, we need to tell our patients if the pill changes in color or shape, it could be a change in generic. And if you're concerned that it's the wrong medication, please contact the office or contact the pharmacy.
I would add parenthetically that you may have seen this week also data regarding generic medications and the huge increase in prices among many of them. I wonder if some of this advantage of generics is going to be obviated by price gouging, which is what it looks like to me.
Yep. For bioequivalent generic medications, their major advantage is the decrease in cost. So anything that increases the cost makes people less likely to take the medication. That's not good.
No. Since we're talking about stuff to take, let's turn to the New England Journal of Medicine, the potential utility of niacin in heart disease.
Elizabeth, this has been very contentious. And I think that this very well done study should nail the lid on the coffin of using niacin in high-risk patients. So let me set the stage. We know that HDL cholesterol concentrations are related to the risk of having heart attacks or stroke. That is, the higher your HDL, the less likely you are to have a stroke or heart attack. So we spent a lot of time trying to develop medications that increase HDL with the hope that it'll lower the risk of heart attacks or stroke. And one of the naturally occurring medications we have that does that is niacin. Now, niacin is actually an essential nutrient. It's also called nicotinic acid or vitamin B3. So what this study did was they took individuals that had known vascular disease. They had a stroke or a heart attack or peripheral vascular disease. They were at high risk. They were already taking a statin, and they randomized them to either receive niacin combined with an agent to decrease flushing or no niacin. This is a study of over 26,000 individuals followed for over 4 years, a randomized blinded study. And what they discovered was that in those that used extended release niacin, Dixon, 2 grams, high dose, that there was no benefit. There was no decrease in heart attacks, strokes, or the need for revascularization, no decrease in the risk of death, but in fact, an increase in significant side effects. It is not beneficial and in fact is harmful.
We love studies like this that actually nail down longstanding questions and do it in this randomized fashion with lots and lots of people in there. So that's a great outcome as far as I'm concerned.
It is. And it also points to the fact that this association with HDL and cardiovascular risk, it's just an association.
Okay, so instead of doing that, don't smoke, keep your blood pressure under control, and do some exercise. Let's turn now to JAMA. Looking at stroke incidence in the U.S. declining, which is really great news. And oops, but if you have one, when should you operate?
2 great studies. The first identified what's been happening with the rate associated with stroke over the last 24 years. This is the well-defined ERIC cohort that's over 14,000 participants at 4 different U.S. communities. None of these individuals had had stroke. So we have 24 years of follow-up to find out what's the incidence of stroke, how often does it occur, and then once it does occur, what's the mortality associated with it. And over the last 2 decades, there's been a significant decrease in the incidence of stroke. Interestingly enough, the decreased incidence was only in those above the age of 65 years. There's also a decrease in mortality by about 20%. Now, that's important because not only do you have the risk of morbidity and mortality associated with stroke, but the other study highlights that when somebody has non-cardiac surgery, if the surgery is done within close proximity to the stroke, within the first 9 months even, there's a dramatically increased risk of having some sort of a cardiac event, a stroke or a heart attack or death.
With regard to this declining stroke incidence, on what laurels are we resting to explain this?
3 things have happened over the last 2 decades, well documented. 1, a markedly increased use of blood pressure lowering medications. 2, a significant increase in the use of statin medications. And 3, a decline in cigarette smoking. Now you say, well, why didn't it decline in those under the age of 65? Well, unfortunately, in that age group, we have an increased incidence of diabetes, obesity, and physical inactivity as well. Those things may counteract any benefit we have of the other risk factor modifications that we mentioned.
You read my mind. I was going to say, let's juxtapose that against these emerging public health matters we talk about so often. So I guess we'll leave it by saying we'll be watching with regard to the incidence of stroke over upcoming decades.
The reason why this is so important, not only in the United States, but worldwide, stroke ranks as the 2nd leading cause of death.
Okay. Finally, then, we're staying in JAMA, but let's turn to something I think is rather interesting. That's the employment of telemedicine, but also the employment of nurses in the management of people who are suffering from chronic pain, particularly timely as we're looking with very greatly increased scrutiny at the prescription opioids.
We've also talked about the fact that chronic pain ends up being a significant problem in the United States. About 3/4 of individuals at some point, especially in their older years, have chronic pain, most of it musculoskeletal. So being able to control that and do it without increasing opioid use is important. Now, let me say one other stage that I'm not even sure you're aware of, Elizabeth. I have been involved with a company that does this automated symptom monitoring. In full disclosure, a company called SpiffyCloud, of which a relative is a co-founder, does this, and I have recorded scripts for them. So I'm familiar with this technology. Let's describe what happened. This study took 250 people that had chronic pain. It was severe. It was musculoskeletal over 3 months. But in fact, most of these had pain for 5 years. And they randomized them to the usual care, whatever the physician thought was best to manage their pain, or second, using an automated symptom monitoring system, either over the phone or with an internet. And here's how that works. The phone would call the patient, or the internet would notify the patient and say, how's your pain? And they would grade it upon the severity and whether it was interfering with their life. If the patient indicated that things were not going well, it would trigger a call to the nurse. The nurse would contact the patient, and they had an algorithm of exactly how they were going to address the pain. And opioids were at the very last. Patients in the intervention group were nearly twice as likely to report a 30% improvement in pain as those that received usual care. Just as important, there were very few patients in the group that needed to have any opioid intervention at all. When you look at the numbers needed to treat, you needed to treat 4 individuals with this automated system monitoring to improve symptoms by 30% in 1 individual.
That's pretty good.
And importantly, this is very cost effective because this really costs pennies to do. And the only time you involve the healthcare personnel is when an intervention needs to be done. When the patient triggers and said, I'm not doing quite as well, you already have the algorithm worked out. So it really doesn't take very much time at all. So for chronic conditions like this, or for other things like monitoring hospital discharge or how someone's done after surgery, I think this holds great promise.
And because I like it so much, that's the one that I'm going to talk about on the blog this week. On that note, then, that's a look at this week's medical headlines from Johns Hopkins. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all live well.